You're in tune to KZSU Stanford. It's time for another edition of Raising Sand.
I guess you could call it our summer of freedom, the year that we both turned 18. Fresh out of high school, we hitchhiked to Denver. Maud, we was a sight to be seen. That was the year that you dated my cousin till they took us away in the fall. And I surely wish that you were here with me as I touch your name on the wall. Touch your name on the wall. Touch your name on the wall. Lord, help us all. Touch a name on the wall.
Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, with Annie and the Vets doing Joel Mobus' song, Touch a Name on the Wall. This refers to the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, also known as the Wall, and is a memorial to those who served in the Vietnam War, both living and dead. There is an online database of 58,195 names on the wall from a war that lasted, most historians agree, from about 1961 through 1975. Today we'll spend the hour with Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter Deborah Nelson, who has written a book called The War Behind Me, Vietnam Veterans Confront the Truth About U.S. War Crimes. For this book, Deborah Nelson researched recently declassified collections that represent the largest compilation of U.S. war crime reports from the Vietnam conflict ever to surface, including more than 300 allegations by hundreds of Vietnam War veterans. Most of these actions are not known to the public, even though the military investigated them. In fact, Deborah Nelson contends that most Americans still think the violence was the work of a few rogue units, unquote, when in fact every major division that served in Vietnam was represented. Deborah Nelson, how did you come to this subject?
Well, let me back up just a little bit to explain how I came to the topic, because it requires going back to the 1970s when this incredible archive was created. After Cy Hirsch published his expose on the My Lai massacre in late 1969, the Army assembled a small group of officers to see if there were any other scandals lurking out there. They did this on the direction of President Nixon, who wanted the Army off the front page. A small group of officers was assigned to sweep up any allegations of atrocities that had been reported to the Army investigators, or that had crossed the desks of members of Congress, or that had been disclosed at public forums or somewhere in the media, you know, often on the inside pages. Over 5 years, they collected roughly 9,000 pages of evidence of atrocities. But unlike My Lai, which resulted in some sort of public accounting, there wasn't any public accounting of this. They kept their findings secret, and the records were locked up after the war ended. They remained classified until 1990. But then sat on the storeroom shelf at the National Archives, kind of like the last scene in Raiders of the Lost Ark, for about 10 years before a small group of scholars and journalists discovered them. And one of them was Nick Terse, who was doing his, who was at Columbia University at the time, and he did his dissertation on the records. He thought that some of the cases might be newsworthy, even this many years later, so he contacted the LA Times, where I was the editor of the Washington investigative team. And so his inquiry was forwarded to me, and we teamed up to investigate the origins of the records and what came of them. And that, you know, and that's what launched our investigation, which led to interviewing scores of veterans, former Pentagon officials, suspects, victims. We traveled to Vietnam, and we put all the information in a couple spreadsheets.
there probably could have been other things coming across your desk, but something about this caught your eye. I mean, you could have let this go.
Yeah, I have to be, you know, honest. I wasn't immediately persuaded. I had a hard time justifying pouring my time and LA Times resources into an investigation of Vietnam War atrocities when we were in Iraq and Afghanistan, and I really felt that we weren't giving enough attention to those wars. But, you know, as I started reading through the records, I was so moved by the soldiers' accounts that I really developed the belief that the information they conveyed about history in the war was too important to keep from the public, we needed to get that information to the public, even if it was 30 or 40 years late. Mm-hmm.
And then you traced James Henry. He became part of your story also.
Yes, he was an Army medic in 1968-69, and his company was in Quang Nam province, which was very hostile territory, a lot of bloodshed on all sides in that area. His company entered a hamlet on February 8, 1968, tiny rural hamlet. This is about a month before the My Lai massacre occurred. They entered a small hamlet, and they rounded up 19 civilians. There were babies, children, teenagers, women, and one elderly old man. And the lieutenant asked the captain, what should I do with them? And according to many witnesses, the captain radioed back, kill anything that moves. Mm. And with that, several members of the company opened fire. Mm. Now, Jamie Henry was standing nearby. He heard the radio transmission and stepped outside of a hut where he was standing in time to see the massacre occur. And when he returned to the United States, he reported what he saw. Many men didn't report what they saw. Some did, but many didn't report it in Vietnam because their superiors were aware of what was happening and didn't do anything about it. There was a feeling that if you reported something like that, you'd get a bullet in the back. But as soon as he got back to the United States he served in 68, 69. It was actually 67, 68. When he got back in the fall of 68, he reported it to an investigator who accused him of lying. So he made one more attempt to bring this to somebody's attention, and that was in early 1970. He had a press conference in L.A. that resulted in a couple inside stories in which he made reference to the massacre that he witnessed. And he wrote a detailed story about it in an obscure little magazine. This finally got the Army to interview him, and he gave them a 10-page detailed statement that described the massacre and a number of murders leading up to the massacre and the months prior to the massacre. As far as he knew, the Army did nothing more with it, but in fact, they carried on a 3.5-year investigation, interviewed 100 men, or contacted 100 men, interviewed scores of them, and confirmed everything that he told them. When they finished the investigation, it was sent up the chain of command, and nothing came of it. It disappeared. No one was prosecuted. The findings were never made public. And the first that Jamie Henry knew that this investigation had taken place and that the investigation had confirmed what he told investigators was when we contacted him in the fall of 2005. Mm.
And you actually have a very touching scene there where you go to his house carrying a large file, and he goes through the file and realizes that a lot of this has to do with the allegations that he made.
Yes, in fact, the file, you know, his case was one of hundreds of cases in the files. And what we brought to him was a 3.5-year investigation. He was surprised and happy to see that so many men from his company told the truth when asked by investigators what happened. Mm-hmm. He was surprised to find that the case had been so thoroughly investigated, but not so surprised to find out that it had been covered up.
I want to ask why it would be covered up, but I mean, it makes sense. If you're fighting a war, you don't want this kind of information getting out because there's going to be a popular clamor back home to end the war. But there already was a popular clamor back home.
There was, but the, you know, disclosure that we, in fact, were much of the clamor back home had to do with the loss of American lives and the belief that this is an unjust war. Certainly, Milai put a very bright spotlight on the fact that Vietnamese were also paying a high price. Vietnamese civilians were in this war, and also raised the specter that U.S. soldiers could commit the same sort of atrocities that we'd always chalked up to, you know, less civilized societies. But I think a lot of the attention was focused on our loss of lives, and not so much on the Vietnamese. What these cases threatened to do was to keep that spotlight that Cy Hirsch shone on American atrocities, to keep that on.
Mm-hmm.
And the administration did not want to be embarrassed, and in some cases, the records, other records show outside of this archive, so that Westmoreland was concerned about being held accountable personally for atrocities during the Vietnam War. So there was, when I talked to the men at the Pentagon who were involved in compiling these records, it was their belief that many of them, that this was, I shouldn't say many because there weren't many, it was a small handful of people, but they were consistent in describing it not as an effort to prevent atrocities or to identify policies or patterns that needed to be changed or to punish. Very few of the confirmed, there were more than 300 allegations in the confirmed cases, confirmed by the Army's own investigation, and very few ended up in prosecution. So none of those were not the motive for compiling these records. What they said the motive was an early warning system so that the administration wouldn't be taken by surprise again, as they were with the disclosure of the My Lai massacre, and to cover their rears.
Mm-hmm.
An elaborate operation to cover their rears. As Jared Schopper, who was the he was in charge, he was an aide to Westmoreland, who was an Army Chief of Staff. His job was to do the day-to-day work on collecting these records, numbering them, you know, filing them, alerting higher-ups when one might cause them trouble. And he said that, you know, his effort was aimed at keeping, he said, Nixon said keep the Army off the front page,
mm-hmm.
and that's what we did. We were successful. His explanation was this. He said that if, you know, they wanted to be sure that they were able to say that every allegation that came to their attention had been investigated.
Mm-hmm.
So when the media called, they could, you know, with an allegation, they could say, oh, yeah, we know about that, and it's under investigation.
Uh-huh.
And they could either say, we investigated it, and it's communist propaganda, as he put it, or it's under investigation. I said, well, what about all the confirmed cases? You know, those findings never were made public. And he said they thought that that would be aiding the enemy by letting the public know that cases had been confirmed.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to quote one of the endorsers of the book, Brigadier General John Johns. He stated, you've performed a patriotic service by bringing this information to the public, the lesson being that we should not allow our leaders to commit our military forces to wars such as the one in Vietnam unless it is essential to our national interest. Now, there's two pieces here that I find really interesting. The first one is you've performed a patriotic service. And that interests me because at the build-up to the invasion of Iraq, and then for the first couple of years after that, there was a very rancorous debate, I suppose we could call it a debate here in this country, about what a patriot is and what patriotism is. And the way there was the side saying a patriot is someone who supports the president no matter what. And then we had other people saying, no, that a patriot is someone who calls our leaders to account. So I find it interesting that John Johns would bring this up, this patriotic service.
I think he did because he felt he, even before we sat down to talk to him, he had thought a lot about this. And he was talking about not only what we did as a patriotic service, but he decided to speak out against the Iraq War. John Johns is an interesting person, interesting character, because he was one of the people at the Pentagon in the 1970s who helped compile these records and keep them secret. And he kept quiet about it even after the war. His belief was that the Army would see this problem and it would deal with it. First of all, he believed that in a counterinsurgency operation like Vietnam, that atrocities were unavoidable, that we had to avoid counterinsurgency operations. And he came to the conclusion by the mid-60s that we should play only an advisory role in Vietnam because it was an unwinnable situation. So when he was at the Pentagon in the 1970s and the atrocity reports started coming over his desk, he wasn't surprised to see them. But he said he believed that the Army would do something about it, that they would come to the understanding that this is what happens in counterinsurgency operations. When the buildup started to the Iraq War, he said he changed his mind. He realized the Army hadn't learned the lessons from Vietnam, and so he started speaking out about the Iraq War. He became one of the early retired generals who is a public critic of it.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly enough, in 2004, he also contacted the Kerry campaign. Now, you know, Kerry was running for president at the time.
Mm-hmm.
He was under attack from the Swift Boat veterans,
mm-hmm,
for his remarks back in 1971 as a young veteran. He testified before the Senate saying that war crimes were common, atrocities were common in Vietnam. Well, in 2004, the Swift Boat veterans went after him for that in some very high-profile ads. And Johns contacted, three times he called the Kerry campaign's office to try to tell them that there was a set of records over at the National Archives that would prove that he was accurate in his characterization of the Vietnam War. But nobody called him back.
Wow. I wonder if that would have made a difference.
The Swift Boat veterans' attacks were pretty effective.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it would have made a difference, I think it was clear the Kerry campaign just hoped that the issue would go away. And he's not really revisited the issue since then.
Well, the other endorser you have is Lieutenant General Robert Gard, Jr., who suggests that we can restore the moral credibility of our country if we deal with and learn from our extensive commission of war crimes during the Vietnam War. That's kind of the crux of what we would like the culture to deal with, isn't it? And yet we're doing something, you know, in Iraq and Afghanistan that is also very tragic.
I think that Johns makes a fairly persuasive argument in the book, and he's made it publicly, that really counterinsurgency operations shouldn't be undertaken except as a very last measure. That that because, you know, when you send foreign forces in to fight a war in populated areas where the enemy, the insurgents, are hard to identify, hard to distinguish from the population, hard to find, that frustration builds. And eventually you have some soldiers who take out their frustration on innocent civilians.
Mm-hmm.
And when that happens, they lose their moral compass.
Mm-hmm.
They lose their you know, moral, their sense of having a moral reason for fighting the war. In addition, it increases support for the insurgents and puts us at an almost insurmountable disadvantage in fighting those wars. So both from an ethical and a pragmatic standpoint, he would argue, counterinsurgency operations are a bad idea. Trying to win, trying to fight insurgents with our military power as opposed to using other strategies, mm-hmm. Is the wrong way to go. And in Afghanistan, right now, you really see that with the, you know, over and again, where, you know, our air attacks and ground attacks are killing civilians. You know, we're reporting, U.S. military is reporting that they kill insurgents and then having to come back and apologize for having actually killed a lot of civilians. That's what often happens when you when you're an outside force responding militarily to an insurgency.
And the other part of John's statement that I found interesting was that we shouldn't commit our military forces unless it is essential to our national interests. And yet that is such a fuzzy area, isn't it? What are our national interests? I mean, in Afghanistan, you could say that our national interests are security, securing our own borders. In Iraq, you could say our national interests are securing an energy source. And yet the national interest is also keeping, as you mentioned, the troops with a solid moral compass.
Well, he would argue, and he could argue better for himself, but I think the point he and others have made is that when we're calculating our national interests in going into war, that we ought to take into consideration not only the potential loss of U.S. lives, but also the potential loss of civilian lives, because even just from a purely pragmatic standpoint, if there's going to be a significant loss of civilian lives, we'll lose moral standing in the world, and we're also more likely to lose the war ultimately, because the population will turn against us. If as in like Afghanistan, where we're supporting the government, the population will turn against that government, and we see that happening in Afghanistan now.
Mm-hmm.
That's a major concern, that the government in place now will lose the support of the people unless civilian killings are curtailed.
I also did an interview a couple of years ago with Professor Philip Zimbardo, the author of The Lucifer Effect. And his point is that it's this point about the moral compass again. You know, he said bad apples come from bad barrels, essentially, and that you can't really expect the troops to maintain, let's call it a moral compass, if there's no model for that in their surroundings. And it seems like that's definitely what was going on in Iraq during the Abu Ghraib era.
What you see in the records from the Vietnam era only reinforces that. You know, when you're in war, I mean, I know Johns makes the arguments that atrocities are unavoidable. Well, some probably are. It's interesting. The veterans I talked to who were on the ground argued that many of them are preventable with stronger leadership on the ground and with better policies from above.
Mm-hmm.
On the ground, you know, the bad policies from the top there, body pressure to produce a high enemy body count, resulted in significant civilian killings, and yet, you know, body count turned up again in Iraq as a measure of success.
Exactly. Yeah.
And it's a bad measure of success, and it leads to a lot of civilian killings. Dehumanization of the enemy is a way to get, you know, U.S. forces to kill combatants. Leads to killing of civilians, too, because you're devaluing the entire population. Search and destroy missions and free fire zones that encouraged U.S. forces to kill anything that moved. The use of firepower and artillery in populated areas, as we're, you know. On the ground, There was a pattern of commanders carrying out these policies, even as the evidence mounted that they were leading to substantial civilian deaths, mm-hmm. because they were both pressured and rewarded for doing so. Commanders who didn't intervene when individual soldiers took out their frustration on innocent civilians. As in the Henry case, the violence began with, that he witnessed, began with a stabbing of a pig for sport, and mm-hmm. then shooting of a water buffalo for sport. And then it was a 14-year-old boy who crossed their paths, mm-hmm. taken behind a rock and executed. And a sleeping man shot for target practice. A man thrown under a under a vehicle. Mm-hmm. All of these things occurred in the months leading up to the massacre. Mm-hmm. None of them were reported. None of them were obviously then prosecuted. No one was held accountable. No one was even reprimanded.
And in fact, I'm going to just quote Rush Limbaugh on the Abu Ghraib scandal. He said, well, we're going to punish these people because they're letting off steam. Do you remember that whole discussion? That and the point that we're trying to make here is that, you know, you're going to carry that form of letting off steam for the rest of your life if you're implicated in one of those events.
Tracking down and talking to people who were involved, either as suspects or as witnesses, it's both who carry it with them throughout their lives, both the those who engage in atrocities and those who witness them, mm-hmm. and certainly, of course, the Vietnamese survivors. So the number of people affected is tremendous. And, you know, you bring up Abu Ghraib. There was another case in the files that involved an extensive case of torture, 173rd Airborne Brigade in Bin Din Province. The Army investigators uncovered a 19-month span when detainees were routinely, and it probably went on longer than that, they looked at a 19-month period, detainees were routinely tortured with water rag, similar to waterboarding, which involves near drowning, electric shock. Detainees would be wired to field phones.
And this was sort of ad hoc stuff happening, or was this happening in some kind of a structure?
No, in a structure. This is, these were the techniques that the interrogators used. Mm. They weren't officially endorsed. But they certainly were known, mm-hmm. well known, and they weren't stopped. Men tried to, in that case, there were a dozen members of the interrogation or the military intelligence detachment who sent letters reporting the torture. They got together and said, we've got to stop it. We've got to do something about this. Sent it to the inspector general, who sent a major down to talk to them and who ended up threatening them. With prosecution, mm-hmm. rather than the people who were interrogating. Mm-hmm. Later on, a couple years later, while investigating a different case, Army investigators came across the evidence of torture and, in fact, confirmed that more than 100 incidents had occurred during this 19-month period. They identified a dozen suspects, or 20 suspects, eight of them, at least, had admitted using torture on detainees, mm-hmm. and yet not a single one was prosecuted. The findings were kept secret. The public was never told. The Army never dealt with the torture issue then, and I think it's not coincidental, not entirely, separate, that the torture came up again, mm-hmm. At Abu Ghraib.
And again, for example, a good officer like Taguba was the fall guy when he reported, when he was given the project of investigating, and then he reported actually what he found. He was retired.
Exactly. If you don't acknowledge what's happened, then we repeat it. Mm-hmm. That's what we've seen. We're having to learn the lessons of Vietnam all over again in Iraq and Afghanistan. Mm-hmm.
This is Raising Sand Radio at KZSU FM 90.1. I'm Susan Gallimore talking with Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter Deborah Nelson, author of The War Behind Me, Vietnam Veterans Confront the Truth About U.S. War Crimes. Let's take a short break and listen to the entire piece of Annie and the Vets doing Joel Mobus' song, Touch a Name on the Wall. The story behind Annie and the Vets is the coming together at the beginning of the War on Terror of Vietnam veterans and Veterans for Peace members Anne and Phil Flager and George Johnson to play music. George Johnson became the lead singer, having, as he put it, prior to co-creating the band, only sung in the shower. Annie and the Vets subsequently made at least two albums, Touch a Name on the Wall and Singing Peace to Power, and you can order these CDs online. CD Baby has them, for example. You can also see a lot of their music on YouTube.
I guess you could call it our summer of freedom, the year that we both turned 18. Fresh out of high school, we hitchhiked to Denver. Thought we was a sight to be seen. That was the year that you dated my cousin till they took us away in the fall. I surely wish that you were here with me as I touch your name on the wall. Touch a name on the wall. Touch a name on the wall. Lord, help us all. Touch a name on the wall. Every time I come here, I wear my fatigues to honor the men that I knew. I touch every name of the ones in my outfit, and I say them out loud as I do. Some people say these men died for nothing, but I just can't rightly agree. This brother here didn't die for no country. He died for me. Touch a name on the wall. Touch a name on the wall. Lord, help us all. Touch a name on the wall. Mostly walls are made to divide us. They separate me from you. But God bless the wall that brings us together, reminds us of what we've been through. And goddamn the liars and the tin-plated heroes who trade on the blood of these men. God, give us the strength to stand up and tell them never again. Touch a name on the wall. Touch a name on the wall. Lord, help us all. Touch a name on the wall.
Deborah, a couple of things. One is, talk about how you have worked with this project for so long, finding out the kinds of things that you understand about the military and about how people can be in the military.
Well, I guess the flip side of finding out that of going through files full of reports of atrocities is that the records also show that hundreds of men were angered and outraged enough to overcome the tremendous obstacles thrown in their way to report these crimes. Mm-hmm. Many more men reported them than I think we knew in the past to the Army. And even those who didn't report them when they were approached by investigators told the truth. I should make this point. One thing the archive doesn't show is that most U.S. soldiers committed atrocities. Most did not. I think it's fairly safe to say that more were involved in atrocities than the Army has led on to. It was a more common problem. It was a systemic problem, not isolated incidents. But most didn't participate. And many of them were outraged by the atrocities occurred, outraged that those who committed got away with it, and angry that military leaders not only let it happen, but by their policies actually encouraged them.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, the Veterans for Peace is one of the largest organizations for veterans against war at this point, and very active still. In the current wars, and in fact supporting the groups like Iraq Veterans Against War.
Yeah, and many of them tried to alert the Army and the public about what was happening in an effort to stop, as one soldier wrote to General Westmoreland, to stop all the wrong killing. But people, you know, the other thing that surprised me about in this investigation was going back and seeing how many atrocities were disclosed, how many were brought to the public's attention. But there's very little memory of those cases. People I talk to all the time, they remember the My Lai massacre. They remember the Green Beret case, a handful of other cases that received sustained front page attention. Many of these other allegations were put in the inside of the paper. The media didn't do independent investigations of them, except in rare occurrences, such as Cy Hirsch, such as Kevin Buckley, who did an investigation for Newsweek, in which he went from hospital to hospital in Vietnam and interviewed residents, interviewed military officials, and established that thousands of civilians had been killed in combat operation down there. They'd been, you know, the public had been told that they were combatants that were killed. They were enemy Viet Cong, but in fact they were innocent civilians. But that sort of independent reporting that put the media behind, you know, that put the power of the press behind the allegations didn't occur very often. So most of them were reported at forums that got little attention from the press, maybe were buried inside, and sometimes were treated with some skepticism.
Would you say one of those forums was the Winter Soldier testimonies?
Yes, in Detroit. It received very little attention. And, you know, there's been a Winter Soldier for Iraq and Afghanistan, and the same thing.
Very little attention, yeah. Except for the alternative media did a good job on it, but very little other mainstream media, as we call it.
Well, and in fact, most of the aggressive reporting has been, this time around, has been done by the alternative media. Mm-hmm. Salon, Mark Benjamin there.
Yeah, he's done some excellent work. Yeah,
really great work. The Nation, Chris Hedges and others have done tremendous work there.
Have you personally been receiving any kind of negative emails or negative feedback?
I've received a mix. I received, some people wondering, you know, why write about this now? Why not write about what the Vietnamese did to us and to their own people?
Mm-hmm.
That's a common reaction. I find that whenever you bring up war crimes, there is a certain segment out there that just doesn't want to talk about it. That they tried to deflect an honest discussion. They've been trying to deflect an honest discussion, I think, about our own culpability for decades. First by saying, war crimes by U.S. troops were an anomaly. Now, you know, faced with the Army's own record showing otherwise, by talking about what Vietnam combatants did to our soldiers or their own people, well, it just seems to me we need to own up to what we did, because ultimately we're responsible for our own actions.
Mm-hmm.
And now I also have heard from many vets who were very supportive of the book, that and who've added their stories to the ones that I reported. I think there are a lot of men out there who have been, you know, have had to keep this terrible secret all their lives,
right,
because you know, they're both have to be concerned about the left and the right.
Right.
You know, if they talked about what happened, they were baby killers or they were traitors,
mm-hmm,
depending on who the audience was.
Right.
So they just didn't talk about it. The lessons learned weren't passed on.
That seems to have changed a little with this war on terror, there's support for the troops. You don't hear the baby killer thing as much. But the conversation still hasn't really aired out, has it? We're still not talking about what this means, why it happened back then, why we didn't examine it, and why it's being repeated now.
No, we've had a lot of trouble, I think, with self-examination on this issue. And I think it's because, as I said, when you bring up the issue, the conversation very quickly becomes emotional and not based on facts or evidence. I've had a number of conversations with veterans who just won't. If you say to war crimes, and you're saying all troops committed war crimes,
right? Yeah.
And I think that's a cop out. That's a way to prevent the conversation from happening. We need to own up to the fact that we did commit war crimes, and we need to figure out why, if we ever hope to prevent them, to both deal with the past and to prevent them from happening again in the future.
It also allows us to have a conversation about, for example, those that are psychologically wounded. As you mentioned, what we're seeing now with this war is a lot of psychologically damaged people, and that kind of gets swept under the rug much more so than do the physical wounds, which are easy to identify. It's the psychological wounds that last for so long, though.
Yeah, I talked to one of the members of Jamie Henry's company who had been the radio telephone operator for the lieutenant who was identified in the Army investigation as the person who first opened fire on the civilians. And he talked about how, after he got back from Vietnam, that he became an alcoholic, his marriage fell apart, mm-hmm, he had a nervous breakdown. He turned his life around, gave up drinking, remarried, but suffered from nightmares all his life. And when we called him and left a message, I just kind of left a vague message. I wanted to talk about some records, declassified records from the war. He called back at his wife's urging, and he knew exactly what we wanted to talk about.
Mm.
It was as if he had been waiting for the phone call his whole life. But what happened to him after the war wasn't unusual.
Yeah, I'm in the San Francisco area, and we have a veterans group here called Swords to Plowshares, and they're very effective, and they deal with veterans, and predominantly at this point with the Vietnam veterans. That's our largest homeless population in the area. So it doesn't go away, and we often just leave those people to their own devices.
You know, I was concerned also when we went to Vietnam about reopening, painful memories of survivors there. But found that, of course, that the survivors, the mothers, the wives, the people who lost loved ones in atrocities, they had, of course, thought about their losses every day of their lives since the war. It wasn't a pain that they had put away or that had gone away. But I got an interesting reaction. They were comforted to find out that somebody from the United States also remembered their loss.
And, of course, what's living on over there is the ongoing devastation from the toxic chemicals that were used.
Yes, in fact, that, of course, is a major issue and that we encountered when we were over there. You know, that there were fact-finding groups looking into that very issue. So we were a little bit out of step because we were over there to talk about other types of atrocities. But Agent Orange, here it is 40 years later, and we're just now coming to grips with the devastation that caused.
Into the third and fourth generations. Deborah Nelson, author of The War Behind Me, Vietnam Veterans Confront the Truth About U.S. War Crimes. Can people get in touch directly with you?
They can reach me through the website, which is thewarbehindme.com. And I think that my email address is up there, but it's easy to remember, thewarbehindme@yahoo.com.
Okay, thewarbehindme.com and thewarbehindme@yahoo.com. I want to thank you for being with us today and sharing these this information. And people can find the book on Amazon and the website.
And there are hopefully there are independent bookstores.
Yeah.
Yes, and there's a list of places on the website.
Deborah Nelson, before we leave, I'd like to give you the opportunity to add anything on this process, the writing the book.
No, I guess I want to say that I hope it helps set the record straight on an issue that's divided us for decades. And by giving everyone, from whistleblowers to suspects to Pentagon officials, a respectful space to explain what happened. And that way, I hope the book moves us to at least a few inches closer to a civil, fact-based, national conversation about what happened and what we should learn from it. You know, in his review of the book, Chicago Reader columnist Michael Miner wrote, "When will this reporting matter? When will what it tells us become part of what we all know about war?" And that's my hope. That this becomes part of what we all know about war.
And that we can act on what we know.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
As Deborah Nelson mentioned, besides the recognized toll that the war took on the United States, our society and culture, and the U.S. military, there is an ongoing toll on the people of Vietnam who continue to suffer the effects of Agent Orange and other chemical defoliants used in large areas of that country during that time. Raising Sand Radio has done a number of shows on that topic, and you can find those on our website, raisingsandradio.org. In fact, we have interviews with Vietnamese people talking about the ongoing effects of these chemical defoliants, particularly Agent Orange. Before we end our show today, it is my great pleasure to announce that David Boajian will receive the Humanitarian Award from the Mid-Atlantic Knights and Daughters of Vartan. Writer-activist David Boajian appeared on Raising Sand Radio last year, sharing his investigative work about Armenian genocide denial, and his work sparked a public outcry involving Armenian activists and then New Jersey Governor Christine Todd Whitman in 1998. You can find David Boajian's interview on the Raising Sand website. Also, we've had talking with us about Armenian issues, Armenian-American Harut Sasunian detailing the background to the current disagreement between Turkey and Israel over the bombardment of Gaza. This disagreement resulted in further insights into how Turkey and Israel control a necessary airing of the topic of genocide in general, and in particular, the Armenian genocide. Go to the website Raising Sand Radio to learn more about these shows and to listen to them on our archive. That's our show for today. As usual, all views are those of the host and guests and not KZSU or Stanford University. Thanks for listening and join us again next week when we talk with David Schoenbrunn of TransDef, Transportation Solutions Defense and Education Fund, a nonprofit environmental organization created by transit activists to advocate for better solutions to transportation, land use, and air quality problems in the San Francisco Bay Area. We'll be talking about the whys and what fors on high-speed rail, BART extensions, climate change, peak oil, and so forth. Join us. Meanwhile, let's go out with another piece from Annie and the Vets, this one from their album Singing Peace to Power called There's a Woman.
There's a woman trapped inside my body. I hear her crying at night. She's longing to be free. But I can't let her, 'cause I'm a bad old cowboy. And a cowboy in a party dress just ain't right. From my Stetson on down to my spurs, I wear only what you think a man prefers. But when I see a woman dressed in high heel pumps and furs, Lord knows how bad I want to change my outfit for her. 'Cause there's a woman trapped inside my body. I hear her crying at night. She's longing to be free. But I can't let her, 'cause I'm a bad old cowboy. And a cowboy in a party dress just ain't right. In a bar room, drinking with my friends, every head turns to the tall blonde walking in. And as they hoot and holler and undress her with their eyes, in my mind I gather up her things and try them on for size. 'Cause there's a woman trapped inside my body. I hear her crying at night. She's longing to be free. But I can't let her, 'cause I'm a bad old cowboy. And a cowboy in a party dress just ain't right. Not a cowboy in a party dress just